Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Audible is the home of storytelling, from audiobooks across every genre to all your favorite podcasts and exclusive Audible originals. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Audible is the destination for thrilling audiobooks with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to pique your curiosity and sense of mystery. Best-selling titles like First Lie Wins, or the upcoming Stephen King novel, You Like It Darker. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text BUILT to 500-500. So we've talked a lot on How I Built This about AI, and today AI is no longer a plaything. It's a business imperative. Your team spends half their time writing, and one confusing email can turn into 12 confused replies and a meeting to get back on the same page. Grammarly is a trusted AI writing partner that saves your company from miscommunication and all the wasted time and money that goes with it. I have really found Grammarly to be super helpful to save time with generative AI prompts. It's also super easy to stay organized because Grammarly works great with other programs that I already use. Grammarly works everywhere you work and integrates seamlessly across 500,000 apps and websites. No cutting, no pasting, no context switching. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, everything gets better. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Learn more at Grammarly.com. You only get one chance to go public, and the stakes are high. Deloitte's free IPO readiness tool will help you grade your current state of readiness. Less than 10% of companies using Deloitte's free tool discover they're ready for an IPO. While the IPO market can be unpredictable, your company's readiness plan doesn't have to be. Don't miss your IPO window. Being ready starts with getting ready. With Deloitte's free and easy-to-use IPO self-assess tool, you can gauge your IPO readiness and receive tailored insights on 9 areas of focus in less than 30 minutes. Visit Deloitte.com/US/HIBT and launch your IPO journey today. Hey, really quick before we bring you a brand new episode of How I Built This, we are now doing twice weekly live video conversations with founders and entrepreneurs around the theme of building resilience in a time of crisis. So come bring your questions and learn how other businesses are working through the challenges. This Wednesday, April 15th, join me and Gary and Kit Erickson of Cliff Bar. And on Friday, April 17th, I'll have acclaimed thinker Simon Sinek, author of Start With Why, on the show. You can join the conversation live at facebook.com/howibuiltthis. They happen Wednesdays and Fridays at 12 noon Eastern. Again, that's facebook.com/howibuiltthis, and you don't need a Facebook account to watch. Okay, and now onto a brand new episode of the show. And just a warning, there's a little salty language in this episode, so if you're listening with kids, just be mindful. You went to your executive team and you present this plan, and within a year, they all left. Basically, your entire top-level execs are gone.
Yeah. I remember, like, the last one where we thought it couldn't get any worse, and I get the text from someone, and it's always, like, the worst text when someone says, "Hey, can you talk?" And then, so the last person quits, and we're just like, oh, God, what are we going to do?
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on today's show, how three friends from college opened a salad shack in Washington, D.C., and grew that into Sweetgreen, a chain of salad restaurants that wants to transform the way we think about fast food. Okay, so first, before I get into today's episode, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Because on my end, I think I'm probably going through what you're going through, which is a mixture of anxiety and hope. And as far as this show is concerned, as corny as it may sound, a renewed sense of mission. Because, as I've said before, How I Built This is not really a show just about business. I've never thought about it that way. It's a show about possibility, and possibility isn't just about all of the good things that can happen. It's about the possibility for things to go downhill. Possibility encompasses failure and loss, but also rebirth and triumph and creativity and a path forward, which is why this show isn't something I just host. I'm actually a fan of these stories. I love them. They're like rocket fuel for days when I'm feeling down or unmotivated, like kind of like these days, right? Which brings me to today's story, because it really is about possibility and all it entails. Sweetgreen started out as a classic problem looking for a solution. The problem was bad food options. Three undergraduates at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. were sick of bad cafeteria food. Jonathan Neiman, Nicholas Jamay, and Nathaniel Rue wanted fresh, healthy, vibrant salads. Not iceberg lettuce with some gloppy ranch dressing. They wanted things like avocado and arugula and red cabbage and fresh kale. And believe it or not, these things were not easy to find at restaurants in Washington, D.C. in 2007. So Jonathan, Nicholas, and Nathaniel decided to solve the problem themselves. A better lunch option for them and for their fellow students at Georgetown. With some seed money they raised from friends and family, they fixed up a rundown shack near campus, they launched a takeout salad restaurant a few months later, and almost didn't make it out of year one when the cold winter weather slowed business to a trickle. But nearly 15 years on, none of these three founders could have imagined that Sweetgreen would become one of the leading fast casual salad restaurants in America with more than 100 locations. And last year, investors valued Sweetgreen at more than $1 billion. $1 billion for salad. But actually, what's probably most interesting about the Sweetgreen story is a major pivot the founders took in 2018 when they decided to slow down the expansion of their restaurants. But we'll get there. The thing is, when I spoke to Jonathan and Nicholas back in early March, none of us knew that just days later, the entire world was about to change in a most profound way. So at the end of this episode, I'll reach back out to them for an update about how things are going right now. But for the moment, let's dive into that first conversation with Jonathan Neiman and Nicholas Jamay. So Nicholas, tell me, you grew up born and raised in New York City.
I was born and raised in New York City. My parents had come to the U.S. a few years before I was born. And my father was French and my mother was Swiss-Lebanese. And so I grew up in a very, what I would say, strict French household.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And French-speaking. So it was actually my first language.
And they ran a restaurant in New York. It's called La Caravelle.
It was called La Caravelle. And it was one of those very old-school fine dining French restaurants of a former generation. Typical ladies who lunch, you know, Jackie O would go there for lunch a couple times a week. And it was a really chic, old-school New York environment and where you'd sit down for a three-hour lunch.
And what do you remember as a kid? I mean, would you be in there all the time?
You know, most of my childhood, I actually remember being either there in the restaurant or in the kitchen there or in the office. And if I wanted to see my parents and wanted to spend quality time with them, I was quite often at the office with them. And, you know, looking back now as an adult with a business, I commend my parents because they did a great job balancing, and they'd come home sometimes for dinner and then they'd run back to the restaurant for at night. But there wasn't one weekend where they didn't work. I think my dad didn't take a day off for, I would say, probably a decade at least. And I'd watch him get up at 5 in the morning every day and, you know, he'd go do everything himself. Flower market Monday morning, 5 a.m., fish market, meat market. He wanted to go actually see the product, meet the vendors and actually, you know, bring it back to the restaurant. Mm. He was very hands-on. And then when the restaurant opened, he was there greeting every single customer. There wasn't one guest that walked into that restaurant that wasn't greeted by my parents.
So when you it was time for you to go to college, you went to Georgetown, and was it your – I mean, did you have a sense already then that you wanted to – what you wanted to do? Like, did you think, oh, I'll go study finance or economics, I'll go to a bank and I'll come back to New York and work on Wall Street or something like that?
Growing up in that environment and watching my parents run that business, I always loved the idea of being an entrepreneur. And so even in high school, you know, I became pretty obsessive with the idea of just being an entrepreneur and trying to learn as much as I could. In high school, I fought really hard to start the entrepreneurship club. And so there's a group of students that would get together every week and just dissect businesses, talk about entrepreneurs.
You were that kid.
I was that kid.
Oh my gosh. Wow. All right. So I want to just hit the pause button for a sec and bring in Jonathan Neiman, because you grew up in – where did you grow up? In L.A.?
I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And your family were – Iranian Jews, they left Iran during the revolution and came to L.A. like a lot of Iranian Jews and non-Jews.
Yeah, so my parents left during the revolution in around 1979, and they both had to leave suddenly. You know, they were relatively well off in Iran, and then one day their life changed, and they had to leave almost everything and kind of come to America and start over.
Yeah.
I kind of lived, you know, like my early childhood was very much always that worry that what we had was not permanent and that you could lose it at any moment.
And what did when your parents came to LA and sort of start over, what did they do? What was their work?
Yeah, so my dad worked with his two brothers, and he did what he was doing in Iran, which was he was an importer of textiles, and then he would sell textiles. And so my early memories were going to see my dad at his office, and he had a warehouse, and I remember, like, my dream was to, like, be able to ride the forklift that would carry, like, the rolls of fabric, and that's what he did. He sold rolls, you know, he would design fabric and sell rolls of fabric to brands and manufacturers to make garments out of. And similar to Nick, I think starting a business was always almost an expectation. Everyone I looked around...
Not to be a doctor or an engineer?
No, right? it was...
Because every time I've interviewed some an Iranian American, they say, oh, my parents want me to be a doctor and engineer.
It wasn't that they talked about me being an entrepreneur, but that's all we saw, is I saw my dad work with his two brothers, saw most of their friends were entrepreneurs, and not a lot of people had big businesses, but they worked for themselves. We didn't know a lot of people that had jobs. And from a very young age, that's what I wanted to do.
So you go to Georgetown for college as well. I mean, did you guys even know each other from day one? Were you like best friends, or like what's the story? What do you remember, Jonathan?
Yeah, so Nick was the first person I met when I got to Georgetown.
Wow.
So I remember very vividly, you know, you cart all your stuff into the dorm, and I see Nick and his mom Rita right next door to me. And he was the first person that greeted me when I walked into my dorm.
Yeah, it's funny. Growing up in New York, I had actually never been to L.A. I didn't really have any friends from L.A., and so I met this kid, and I'm like, wow, he seems different. He's from L.A. He's wearing a Lakers t-shirt, and he's got a different energy about him, and, you know, I knew we'd be friends, but first person I met at Georgetown.
And were you friends right away, or did you kind of have your own groups of friends?
We were friends, but it was really interesting now, considering what we do together. We were friends that shared really – the thing that we shared the most was a love for food.
Huh.
So, like, from the very beginning, we were food friends. You know, in college, you kind of have these, like, functional friends. You have food, friends you go see concerts with, friends you go do movies with. Nick and I were food friends.
Well, I understand it about Nick, because he grew up around food. He grew up around restaurants. But what was your thing? Like, where'd that come from?
I just always loved food. Some people eat to live and others live to eat. I just, like, loved the experience of food, the sharing of food, everything about it. It just has always been something I've loved.
So you guys were your friends, and you meet this other guy, Nate, and did you also become friends with him pretty quickly?
Yeah, Nate and I became very close friends immediately. Nate's also from Los Angeles.
Right.
And so Nate and I just saw each other and immediately bonded. You know, I remember seeing him in accounting class. He was sitting in front of me, and he was wearing an LA Dodgers cap, and I was wearing like a Lakers t-shirt.
Yeah.
And we looked at each other, and we're like, we're going to be friends. And we just bonded over being from L.A. and loving music. And we became fast friends. Nate and I ended up being roommates for 2 out of the 4 years of college.
Wow. All right. So you guys are all at Georgetown. This is in the early 2000s. And it comes time to graduate. How did the idea of, even before you start Sweet Green, how did the idea of working together even begin? Would you talk about it in college? Like, hey, maybe we should like do something together after college. Were you having those conversations?
I think the three of us all had this entrepreneurial itch, and You know, all of our parents were immigrants. All of our parents were entrepreneurs. Nick talked about starting the Entrepreneurs Club in high school. I also started the entrepreneur. I just found this out.
He was also that kid.
I was also that kid. I just found this out this week. I also started a Young Entrepreneurs Club in high school. And so we kind of like, we were the three kids that knew we wanted to start a business.
Okay.
And we didn't know what that business was going to be. We just knew we wanted to do something and maybe do something together.
How did the idea of like doing a salad-based like lunch place, how did that even come about?
So at the time at Georgetown, there was one class called entrepreneurship. It wasn't a major, it wasn't a minor. There was this one course taught by a professor named Will Finnerty. And the three of us actually took the class separately. John, I think I was your TA, actually.
Yeah, Nick was my TA in the class.
I loved it so much, I stayed on as a TA. And they talk about how to write a business plan, how to concept a business. You know, one of the things he talked about in that class was some of the best businesses are started by people just trying to solve a problem they have in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so at the same time, we were having that conversation. The food on campus was really bad, like cafeteria especially. And as a freshman, you're forced to buy a meal plan. They force your parents. There's a minimum. You have to buy it. It's really bad. You can go there for, you know, random lunch, but to have every meal there was really tough.
And we were sick of eating. The closest thing we had to healthy food was maybe Chipotle or Subway.
Yeah.
It was just that constant complaint that we had a problem in our own life. And then we heard all of our friends complain about it. And so the original idea was, we wish this was here at Georgetown while we were here.
You wish what was there?
We wish that there was a healthy place to eat that was affordable and convenient and delicious.
Right.
And we thought it was going to be really easy. We thought we could open a restaurant in 2 months, and we didn't really know exactly what the cuisine would be. And so the first location was across the street from where we lived. And on the corner was this old burger shop that was now closed. It used to be called the Little Tavern. The whole time we were at school, it was empty. It was tiny. It was 500 square feet. Mm. And it had a for lease sign on it. And we looked at that. We're like, that's perfect. That's where we should do it. But it was the fact that it was so small had to keep it really simple.
Yeah.
And it was that constraint that was, we're going to do one thing and we're going to do it well.
All right. So there's this 500 square foot restaurant that's available for lease. It's empty. You guys are seniors in college. You're 21, 22 maybe. You all of a sudden you're saying, hey, you know what? Let's see if we can get that place and open up our salad restaurant. And wait, but before, like when your parents were saying to you in the fall of your senior year, hey, Nick, hey, Jonathan, you're going to graduate in May. What are you going to do? Because that's what every senior in college, like that's a question they get asked. In the fall of that year, you were saying, we're going to open up a restaurant. Were you saying that already?
It wasn't real at that point yet. And just to paint a bit of the picture, at first I didn't tell my parents because obviously they were in the business and they'd probably warn me against it. But the way we actually got started, you know, we wrote the business plan, which our first version of a business plan was like 2 pages. It was like one page of financials, a photo of some chair for a design reference, and kind of like a menu concept. And so to John's point, once we saw that little hut, we said, this is where it's got to start. And we somehow found out who the landlord was, called the number in the window.
First of all, it took us almost 2 months to get a meeting because we called her. Her name is Marcy. And we called her. She wouldn't take us seriously. She thought we were kids doing a school project.
You were calling her saying what?
Saying, hey, we have this idea for this restaurant on the corner. Can we come have a meeting?
And once she finally, you know, John called her every day for 30 days. I'll never forget. And she finally called back and said, I'll take a meeting if you stop calling me.
Got it. Yeah.
And that's when she said, you know what? Go back and write a real business plan and show me something real and maybe we can talk.
All right. So you go to Marcy with a business plan, a better business plan, presumably, a couple days later or a week or so later. How did you improve that business plan?
Well, she asked us to do a few things. She asked us to really build out a full business plan, which meant building out some financial projections, which meant building out the team that was going to help execute this, whether that be the architect, the engineer. She's like, do you know how to build a restaurant? She's like, you need an architect, you need an engineer, you need a kitchen designer, you need to think about all of these things.
Yeah.
And I remember we went and stood on the corner and counted people. And we stood in front of the Subway, we stood in front of the Chipotle, we stood in front of the Dina De Luca, and then we stood in front of our corner. And we would just count.
Right.
How many people are walking by? How many people are at the university? How many salads do we have to sell a day? And that was all happening before winter break.
Yeah.
And that's when we were going to like make a call. Is this what we were going to do or not?
And that location, it's on M Street in Georgetown, right? I think just it's important to point out, this is at the very, very end of the retail district of M Street, or at least at that time it was. Like most people really didn't go far beyond M and Wisconsin at that point.
I mean, there's no argument. It was, on paper, a bad piece of real estate.
Yeah.
And that's why I think she gave us a chance, because that piece of real estate had sat there empty for 5 years.
Right.
And she said, you know what? Why not? What have I got to lose?
What was the rent going to be?
The rent was $3,000 a month.
And what were the terms? How long did you have to sign a deal for? 2 years?
5 years.
So she agrees to do this deal with you. And then what? Like, then what do you do?
Then it was time to raise money. We had this business plan that was more buttoned up. We had a landlord that was willing to give us the space. And we had found an architect, someone that she knew. So she felt confident in, you know, us actually building this. And I guess she just saw something in us and we had gotten to know her. And she said, you know, these kids might actually get this thing open.
And how much money did you think you needed to raise to get this off the ground?
We thought we needed $100,000.
Okay, $100,000, that was going to cover the deposit and the rebuild and, you know, your first couple months of just produce sourcing. Mm-hmm. And by the way, in terms of the architect, and what did it look like inside?
It was a concrete box.
Yeah, it was a concrete box. It was – we really didn't know anything. You know, we never – you know, Nate and I had never worked in a restaurant. Nick had some experience working in a restaurant, but he clearly never built a restaurant. And so the space, which, you know, in my head, you see that front line, that line that we make our salads on today. In my head, I figured we could just go buy one of those and plop it in, and didn't really think about the fact that it needed power, water, like a bathroom, all of the things that make a restaurant.
There
a
was
restaurant.
No bathroom there?
There's no bathroom. There was no plumbing.
There's no plumbing. Okay.
There was no sewage, no electricity.
There's no electricity?
You should not have opened a restaurant in this space.
So it was literally a concrete shack.
It was literally a concrete shack.
We always say, thank God we knew nothing, because today or even a couple years in, we would have never even agreed to go tour a site like that.
No
it was
way.
So bad.
Yeah.
But it ended up being the perfect place to start Sweetgreen.
All right. So you get the architect, and what did you have to put in, plumbing and electricity?
Yeah. So I remember when we got the first bid back from the architect, who just did like a projection of how much this was going to cost. And we thought $100,000 was pretty conservative. We're like, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We get it back and it's like $350,000. And we just remember looking at each other like, oh shit, this isn't going to work.
So, I mean, obviously, I mean, you did decide to go forward with it. Where did you go to raise the money?
We started raising money from, you know, anyone that would listen to us. It was friends in school, old teachers, old bosses. We'd each put in some of our savings, but really not much. It was really this process of selling this business plan.
And what was the, like, was there a minimum amount you were asking people to give you? If someone's like, I'll give you $2,000.
We took $2,000.
You take it.
We did take it.
So you did take it, okay.
We asked everyone we could, and it was really hard. I mean, I think the raising money piece is something that, you know, you come with no experience. You know, people are looking at you, they're like, okay, so what have you done before? And everyone likes knows the fact that 99% of restaurants fail in their first year. But you just needed a few people to say yes. And once you found a few people to say yes, they knew a few friends that would then say yes. We probably spoke to 250 people, and we got 50 people to say yes.
And how much did you guys raise?
We ended up raising almost $300,000.
Wow.
And it did cost about $350,000. So we were short $50,000 or so, which means we owed the contractor $50,000 at the end, which means the contractor owned a piece of our company at the end.
Wow. And what about the food? Like, did you start coming up with recipes of salads to serve?
The food was really the fun part, because that's where...
What was going to make it special? What was going to actually get people excited to eat this? And, you know, fast forward to second semester, we had raised some money. We finally signed the lease. We made our first batch of Sweetgreen t-shirts that we all wore every single day, so it felt real. And it was time to figure out the product. And I remember it started just with us. You know, we saw a produce truck drive by, and we just called the phone number on the produce truck and got this produce rep to come to our dorm room with samples. And that's how we started to figure out the menu and what we wanted to serve.
Wow. What was the produce truck?
Keeney produce.
Oh, yeah. You see those all around the Mid-Atlantic.
They are still our partner today. And I'll never forget Joanna, who was our rep, showed up at my dorm room. And she's like, is this the right address? She came with a couple cases of arugula. And I said, yeah, just put it in the fridge right there. And she saw a bunch of college kids partying. And she must have thought we were crazy.
So this is a produce distributor. You know, you're 22 and you have zero experience in business and restaurants. And were they skeptical when they met you?
Actually, they were really good partners from the beginning. There's something I think that when you're 21 years old trying to start a business
I feel like people were kind of rooting for us.
Yeah.
And we always went in very honestly and said, we don't know anything. We've never done this before. Huh. Can you help us?
Huh.
They wanted to see us be successful because we weren't approaching it the same way other restaurants were. Like from the very beginning, we went in and we asked for local and organic food. And they're like, wow, that's different. Why are you, you know, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And so I really think that people wanted to help us from the very beginning.
And then in terms of the menu, how do you come up with that?
You know, again, we were all big foodies and we understood that we wanted the menu to be food that you could eat every day that would make you feel good and food that people would get excited about. And so we started doing these tastings in our dorm room and we'd invite 10 to 15 friends at a time to come try it and give us their feedback. And that's how the first menu was born.
And in terms of like coming up with the first menus, because it's obviously you can make your own salad however you want, right? It's just a bunch of greens and you can vegetables, you can add stuff to it, but you have recommended combinations that you could go in what was the first, like?
So the first menu and part of why we called it Sweet Green was the first menu was salads, wraps, and frozen yogurt. It was really important for us for it not to just be the make your own, but to have these chef crafted combinations. And I remember one of the very first things we made was the guacamole greens.
Yeah, and what was that salad?
So that salad was, the whole idea was taking the flavors and ingredients that go into a guacamole,
yep,
and deconstructing them into a salad. So a bowl that's more vegetal, that's more plant-based, but you still get that experience of crunching into the tortilla chips and the avocado and the dressing, and it becomes a really craveable
moment. It was like
moment.
On arugula or?
Yeah, it was mixed greens and arugula.
Got it, okay. And then it's time to, because I'm assuming you signed the lease in the spring of 2007, right? And you needed to build this thing out. So
our plan was to open in April.
April of 2007.
April in 2007.
When did you sign the lease? In like February?
In like January.
Oh.
January, February, we signed
the
lease.
You signed
but
the lease.
Again, we had no idea what we were doing. We thought building a restaurant, we didn't understand that you had to get permits. We didn't understand.
You had to build an ADA-sized bathroom inside, that you had to like have a storage room, that you had to all these things.
Time.
It takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
And what we didn't realize back to this being a concrete box, in order to get electricity and water and sewage to the space, we had to rip up the street. So the permitting was a complete nightmare. And beyond that, we didn't have enough space in the restaurant, we found out, to do everything we wanted to do. We didn't have enough storage space.
Yeah.
And so what we figured out what to do was, right behind us was a parking lot.
Yeah.
So we went to them and we said, can we rent two parking spaces? And we'll build a storage unit within the two parking spaces. And we'll put all our refrigeration, our extra refrigeration, and all our dry goods in these two parking spaces. And then we would get a cart. Our idea was, we're going to get a cart and we're going to roll down the parking lot for the food.
So you'd have like your refrigerator in... just standalone refrigerator on two parking spots.
Correct.
Which would solve
that problem.
We built a room. We built,
yeah,
like we drywalled, right, two parking spots.
And he agreed to this.
Yes.
So this is where you had your storage facility?
This is our...
How far was it like?
It was like, you know, 30 feet up the block, down a hallway. So it was the...
So you used to like roll a cart.
Every day. A couple times a day,
back and forth.
Yeah.
Wow. And by the way, you were still... this is like your final semester of college... assuming you kind of had a lighter load of classes, but you were still having to go to class, right?
Yeah, we were running in between classes and construction site, and we both lived across the street, so it was actually pretty convenient. But it was this funny trying to finish our classes and finish out, you know, second semester of our last year, but then also starting this thing that was going to be, you know,
yeah.
And funny enough, out of all the restaurants we've opened, out of all the leases we've signed, this first one was almost the one we were least worried about. We had the most confidence in this one because we were, A, because we didn't know anything. We had nothing to be worried about yet. And B, we were building it for ourselves. We were the customer. So there was a confidence there.
I mean, it must have been so exciting. I mean, presumably your friends are like, those guys are building this restaurant. Was there like buzz around it?
There was buzz and, you know, we had a ton of friends and people that were supportive and really believed in it. And at the same time, you know, you get those looks from people like, oh, so that's going to be your real job. You know, I'm going to go work at Goldman Sachs or somewhere else and you're going to go run a 500 square foot salad shop. And I think people thought it was cute and cool, but ultimately didn't think it was going to be our full-time job.
Yeah.
And so we graduate, we're building the restaurant, and it was a really weird time because all of a sudden, all your friends leave.
Yeah.
Everyone leaves DC, everyone graduates, everyone goes home or goes on vacation and going on to their jobs. And we were just there.
Yeah.
And the three of us were living together then, like actually living together and building this thing. And I remember my brother came and lived with us to help us. And he helped us with construction. And we were all doing everything. Like,
yeah.
We were just on site every day doing whatever we could.
All right. Summer of 2007, you're building this thing out. It's hot. It's Washington, D.C. in the summer. And finally, you're ready to open. I think it opens on August 1st, mm-hmm. 2007.
August 1st, 2007.
And the three of you are the only employees, or did you hire
someone? We had a few other employees.
Who are going to help you, who are going to help make this out?
So back up a little bit. So a few days before we're opening, our focus was just get the restaurant ready, right? The menu, the construction, get it ready. And we were really excited for this big opening party. We start hiring employees.
Okay.
And we're like, let's just go get Georgetown kids to be employees,
sure.
Which we thought was a great idea.
Yep.
So kids show up. They show up to our apartment for training. And we decided we were going to have a big opening party. And so we invited lots of friends, family. We were going to have this big party.
Okay.
So we're all hustling to get this restaurant ready in time for the opening. And it was the day before we were supposed to open. And we were running back and forth from that restaurant, getting ready. And we had left the door open or unlocked.
Of our office/apartment. Which was across the street.
Okay.
And we had left the door unlocked. We come back and someone had robbed the apartment. And one of the things they had taken was Nick's laptop.
Wow.
Which had everything on it. It had all of the recipes, all of the training, everything we were going to do to run this restaurant was all of a sudden gone. And this is the days before the cloud. So there's nothing backed up in the cloud. This is like on your hard drive, on your computer. So we're just like, holy shit.
Wow.
What are we going to do?
Yeah, it was one of those stay up all night and figure it out moments. And, you know, like John said, we'd invited all these people from around the country. All of our families from New York and L.A. were coming to D.C. for the opening of this thing we had worked on all year. And we knew we just had to figure it out. And so we stayed up all night looking through emails and trying to piece together, you know, everything we'd created. And we somehow figured it out. You know, we actually remember the party started at 7 p.m. on, you know, the day before opening. And we were still in there at 7:30 p.m., like, finalizing the recipes. And we just got it done. And all of our families pitched in. I remember Nate's dad was in the back making dressing and chopping onions. Your brother was running around buying stuff for us. It was kind of an all-hands-on-deck moment.
So, all right. So August 1st, the restaurant opens. And what was there, a line outside?
There was a line, and we sold a lot of salads, or what we thought was a lot of salads on the day
one. The first day we sold just over 100 salads.
And then you're off to the races? Like, was it?
Kind of. I mean, so
students come back.
We opened August 1st, which is a few weeks before students come back.
Yep.
And so August, you know, chugs along. We're doing well. We have, you know, growing a little bit every day. And we're like, okay, we got this. We know how to do this. And we were bracing for this week when all the students came back. We knew that was going to be when our business really was going to be tested. And I remember, I think it was August 29th or August 30th or something. All the students had come back. And this idea of hiring students to be our employees sounded like a great idea. But once classes start and once all their friends are back, it actually was a horrible idea because I'll never forget, first day of classes, every single employee called out. No one showed.
Wow.
So we had this day. Imagine opening day, 1 month in, first day of classes, the three of us in the restaurant. And I think Nate had just had surgery on his knee and you had stepped out for a moment. So there was this moment on that first day of classes where I found myself alone
by
in the restaurant.
Yeah.
By myself. With a line out the door.
By the way, I'm assuming you're not profitable yet, or was it cash flow like good enough to keep things going where you could see like, okay, this $300,000 that we raised, we're going to be fine for a while?
The first couple of months, we actually got to cash flow profitability pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first winter came. And that's when things got really dicey and really challenged us to think about our business.
Up until the winter, things were fine. People were buying
salad. Yeah, students came back. The line was out the door every day. We hired more employees, non-student employees. September was a great month. October was a great month. And then kids left on break.
Yeah.
And the weather started to turn. And our business really changed.
And like how significantly?
It dropped by almost 70%.
Yeah, after Thanksgiving, you know, there's finals, and then I think around December 10th or 15th,
once
kids start to empty out, you know, it becomes a bit of a ghost town. There's residents there, but so much of our business was the students. We were these seniors that's opened this business right out of college, and so much of our customers were the students.
And today, almost half of our food is warm food.
At the time, it was all cold salads with zero seating.
Yeah.
And very much student-driven. So as soon as the winter hit, it just, our business just disappeared.
Were you working at the store every day?
Double shifts every day. You know, I think we, in that winter, realized we couldn't even afford to have as many employees as we thought. We didn't have a manager. And it came down to counting pennies. You know, there were moments in that first December, that first winter, that we truly thought the business wouldn't survive. It forced us to think about how the business needed to evolve, right? For different customers and different weather patterns, how the restaurant itself needed to be different with seats, our menu needed to evolve. But there were some days in that first December where we almost ran out of money.
So, I mean, I have to assume that what happened was the weather turned and people started coming back. Is that what happened?
Yeah, pretty much. We got killed in that winter, but we learned how to run a very lean restaurant and build an operation that was very, very lean and so could survive off of making a few hundred dollars a day. And as soon as the weather started to get better, in that time, we started to learn how to market. We realized that there was this huge connection between fitness and eating healthy. And so it was partnering with a lot of the run clubs and the yoga studios and anything
that
was—
What would you do? How would you partner with them?
We hosted a run club. We would do, like, coupons and samples after yoga classes.
You would show up at, like, yoga places in around D.C.?
Yeah, and we'd give them little, like, you know, old-school paper coupons.
Yeah.
And just, like, little buy-one-get-one campaigns, simple, like, classic promo stuff.
And that worked?
That started to work. We realized very early on that it was just, like, trial was so important, especially for a new concept. We just had to get people to try it, and then they would get hooked.
So I think it was by the summer of 2008, you guys had pretty much bounced back. And not only that, you were even thinking about opening a second restaurant. Is it right?
Yeah. You know, when we started the first restaurant, it was really just one, let's do one restaurant for ourselves. But after we started doing all the research and kind of like peeling the onion back on the industry, we realized that this problem that we were having in our lives was a major, major problem. There is no healthy place to eat. And the fast food brand of our generation was, or the generation before us, was McDonald's. And it just didn't make sense that there was no brand to replace that. And so very quickly, about a year in, we started to think about, all right, this can be bigger.
So this is early 2009. But just as an aside, I mean, you are from LA.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicholas, you are from New York. Obviously, you were students in D.C. and students at Georgetown, so I'm assuming that's why you started there. But, I mean, was there any advantage to starting in Washington, D.C.? Because it's not really – certainly at that time, certainly not known as an entrepreneurial city. I mean, you had AOL and – but – right?
Yeah. We're so lucky that we started there. We got to make a lot of mistakes. And the Sweetgreen that we started in D.C. would not have been successful in New York or L.A. We needed a lot.
It would have been just crushed by
other. We would have been crushed by the competition.
Yeah.
But it gave us – we were there. We were a D.C.-only brand for over 5 years.
Yeah.
And it let us really tinker with the model and almost get ready for going to these other cities. We got a lot of attention. We were kind of like a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah. So, I mean, fast forward a year, Georgetown is doing gangbusters, is crushing it, and line out the door every day. We figured out the model, you know, the weather hit, and we started to build our second Sweetgreen. We raised about $750,000 for it and started to look for a space that was bigger with seats. We were going to maybe evolve the menu a bit. And we actually opened it right at the largest farmer's market in D.C., the DuPont Circle Farmer's Market. So that was why we picked that site. And, you know, we had started to get much deeper into the, you know, the farmer community. But the problem was that it was on the wrong side of the street. So all the traffic and all the business was actually across the street. So we opened this beautiful, newly evolved Sweetgreen with seats and this new menu. And we thought it was going to do incredible. We thought it was going to beat Georgetown by 50%, you know, sales-wise. And we open our doors day one, and it's crickets.
When we come back, how the crickets went away and the crowd started to show up. And later on, how a major decision to pivot prompted almost all of Sweetgreen's leadership team to walk out the door. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. On How I Built This, we dive into stories behind some of the world's most successful and innovative companies. Everyone measures success in different ways, but one thing's for sure, you can't do it alone. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone.
Their team has a suite of software tools like Jira, Loom, and Confluence that power teamwork for millions of companies worldwide, like Canva. Canva, the world's fastest-growing design platform, is on a mission to empower the world to design. The company has grown from launch in 2013 to over 4,500 employees with more than 175 million people, and over 95% of the Fortune 500 now using Canva to unlock their creativity and achieve their goals at work. Such exponential growth means Canva has had to rapidly scale their internal processes and ways of working to keep up with demand. Atlassian products are helping them navigate that formidable challenge. They use Jira to power their engineering sprints, internal recruitment workflow, and inventory management. Jira Service Management is used for capturing customer feedback and HR requests. With Atlassian, Canva has increased collaboration, processed more than 5,000 tickets per year with ease, and empowered millions of people around the world to bring their creativity to life. Millions of teams around the world like Canva trust Atlassian software to support everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and making beautiful designs. No matter if you're a team of 2 or 2 million, or if you're around the corner or on another continent, Atlassian software keeps everyone connected and moving together as one towards shared goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. When your work presentations and docs look good, you look good. Design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform that helps people at work design compelling visual content. We're all looking for ways to make an impact at work. Canva helps you get your point across visually. It's easy to design impactful Canva presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos. Start with a designer-made template and customize your content. Add images, graphics, charts, and more from the massive media library. Canva makes it easy to wow any audience. I know so many companies and organizations that use Canva to do client pitch decks, stakeholder presentations, and slides for team meetings every single day. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. Hey, welcome back to How I Built This. I'm Guy Raz. So it's the spring of 2009, and a brand new Sweetgreen has just opened in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. It's a great neighborhood. Lots of little shops, lots of people. There's even a famous farmer's market with farmers who could provide them with fresh food. But there's one major problem. That new store is on the wrong side of the street. The quiet, empty side.
So we look across the street to see all these customers, but none of them were on our side of the street. This is when it really hit us that we had to figure out how to connect with those customers and get them to come try our product.
Right.
And so Nate at the time was did some DJing on the side, and so went to Guitar Center, bought a big speaker and a flip table, put it out front, and started just blasting music and trying to create this energy around our store. And we'd be sampling food outside and playing music, and we'd invite all of our friends to come, and it started to work. And on Sundays when the farmer's market was, you know, there were thousands of people walking around that farmer's market, they would start to come over to Sweetgreen now. And so it started to work, and we started to build this community around music and connecting people to the brand through music.
And I just want to mention this for a moment. We're not gonna have time to sort of get into the details of this part of the story, because it could almost be its own episode. But basically, I mean, you eventually built like these sort of music events into a huge, like full-fledged annual festival called the Sweet Life Festival. I remember it because I used to live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming this was sort of like a, in part, like a marketing thing for Sweetgreen. But I mean,
it got huge. Like, you got huge bands to play, like Phoenix and The Strokes and Vampire Weekend and Kendrick Lamar. I mean, and mounting a music festival is expensive. I mean, just
yes.
to pay the band. So how did you...
In retrospect, I don't know what we were doing.
It makes zero financial sense.
The risk we took, the first year especially, the fact that there was not much of a business foundation just in case it didn't work was kind of crazy, but it kind of felt similar to that first restaurant where we just knew that it was going to be successful.
You know, one of the ideas behind Sweetgreen was that we felt like anytime you did find healthy food, it had kind of a branding problem. It was never the coolest experience or the coolest brand. And we were so dead set on creating a brand that stood for more than just the food or the transaction. We saw all these other brands out there that we connected with emotionally and stood for, you know, all these other emotions. And we wanted Sweetgreen to be a brand that people just wanted to be a part of. And so music was one of those ways that we made that connection. And to John's point, it wasn't – on paper, it was a horrible idea, but it just felt right. And it just worked. It really separated our brand from the rest of these other fast casual brands. But the cover of the Washington City paper, I'll never forget it, the morning after the Strokes played, we got the full cover with a photo with a headline that said, "Why did a salad company hire the Strokes?" Question mark. It's kind of like, what the hell are they doing?
Wow. All right. So you pull this festival off and then this becomes a thing. Meantime, you guys, the three of you, I mean, you've got now really have to focus, I have to assume, on raising money. I know you got a very significant investment, $22 million. Steve Case, founder of AOL, he's been on this show. He puts in a big investment into Sweetgreen. By that point, when you raised that money, was it pretty easy for you guys to raise money?
Not quite. And it came from someone on Steve's team, a guy named Evan Morgan. Mm. And Evan Morgan reached out to us. We're sitting down and he's like, "I have this great idea. Let me franchise your business."
And you said?
We laughed in his face.
Hell you no. said, no way. Yeah. We're not going to franchise it. Because yeah. why?
We're control freaks.
Yep.
It's never been part of what we wanted to do because you just can't control what we do. And what we do from a supply chain and scratch cooking perspective, we were just always scared of franchising our business and have never done it.
Okay. But he's looking at you and he's saying, you guys are like 27, 28 years old. Like, franchise this thing. Trust me. You're going to make so much money. That's a pretty convincing argument.
Yeah, and to Evan's credit, the reason he wanted a franchise was because he saw, you know, he bought into what we were doing. He believed that there needed to a food option needed to exist, a brand to own this next generation of eaters. And so through Evan, we got to know Steve and ultimately raised our first institutional round from Revolution.
And Steve Case can be an intimidating guy. I mean, he's a billionaire. He started AOL. Like he you know, he's in the room with you and he's like, okay, here's the money and this is my expectations. And I mean – you had to have been intimidated by that, those conversations. Maybe you know him now, years later, but then, you know.
Yeah, I think we were, you know, you have to remember this was 2013. So it's 6 years into our business. So for 6 years, it was almost felt like we were bootstrapping the business, getting to this yep. point and just doing it with the three of us. We were always very scared of institutional capital. We were scared of raising money from like VCs
Sharks.
Or private equity because that's what it felt like. It felt like we were going to maybe lose our soul or it was –
we're going to say stop organic.
Yeah,
exactly. Go to like Monsanto and get all your – whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. It was those fears of like we've always had this thing where we said from the beginning is how do we get bigger and get better, have the food get better? And we were very scared that bringing in capital was going to force us to take shortcuts. It was going to force us to grow too fast. It was force us to lose control. And in Steve and in all of our partners that we've brought on since then – they know that what makes us special is that we're so protective of our culture and our product. Steve understood that, and he was more a partner in helping us accelerate that than trying to help make us cut corners.
So $22 million in the bank meant that you could really scale it up, right? And presumably, that's why you were able to go to Philly and Boston and New York pretty soon after.
Yeah, and a lot of it was around growth and expansion to new markets. A lot of it was, you know, capital to actually build a real team to think about scale.
Yeah.
And what Steve, what that capital allowed us to do was not plan for the next year, but plan for the next 3 or 5 years and to build a team, to start investing in technology, and to really invest in our brand and platform in a way that created a sustainable business.
When you really started to expand and grow, yeah, I walk into Costco. And, you know, half of the produce is organic. I walk into every store now sells organic this, organic that. And I start to wonder, how is it really organic and sustainable? Is it really – or is it just a different form of agribusiness? Like, you guys were committed to local and organic, and you want, you know, these restaurants all over the country. How are you going to do that? How are you going to – and even today, how are you going to make it so it wasn't an organic agribusiness?
Early on, we realized as we started to scale the supply chain that things like local and organic were both really important to us. But even more importantly was this idea of like full transparency and being fully traceable. We wanted to make sure that we were showing our customers and giving them all the information. And, you know, I'll never forget, I think it was Sweet Green number 4 in Logan Circle was the first restaurant where we put up the source board, the local list that lists every ingredient and what farm they come from. Mm-hmm. And at the time, people asked us why we're putting that up. They thought we were crazy. They said, no one's going to want to know that in fast food. No one needs to know where your chickpeas come from or where your lettuce is from. They'll just trust it. Or customers were used to having a curtain between them and their food.
Yeah.
And we wanted to open that curtain. And actually, at the time, we started also designing our restaurants to be fully open kitchen. So really this idea of building transparency into our model from our supply chain to our physical experience to how we talked about our food. And it really defined this next chapter for us of how we started to scale the supply chain and think about how we invest in our farmers, how we invest in making this a reality.
All right. So you start to expand, and I think by 2015, you hit 40 locations. By the way, just in terms of – I mean, even with all this capital coming in from Steve and from other investors, I have to assume that finding locations in those cities was still hard. Because even though you got a lot of money, Starbucks has a lot more and Chipotle has a lot more, and they want that location. They can outbid you.
You know, as we started – as the brand started to grow and we started to get more press, actually finding real estate got a little easier.
People wanted you as
like an anchor. Wanted us. They wanted like the cool young new brand.
Right.
What started to become a little challenging is as we started to go to cities like New York where rents were much higher, it started to really question the economic model. Like, can we afford those rents? How well will Sweetgreen do there? And those are questions we just didn't really know the answer to. And opening our first Sweetgreen in New York was probably one of the most pivotal moments in our growth because New York is a completely different model. You know, we've learned so much around just volume and scale, and it's really challenged our model. And New York has been incredibly successful for us, and we're very fortunate there. But it's taught us more about our business than almost any other market.
I mean, there's a million choices in New York, right? And there's so many concepts that you see in New York from all over the world that seem great, and then they somehow die.
We were so scared to go to New York because the competition and the level of brands and how people show up there, we didn't think we were ready. And it was a very opportunistic situation that led us to New York where one of our friends was helping develop the Nomad Hotel. And there was this one space next door that they wanted to bring something that was more of a fast food restaurant, but elevated fast food. And they called us and they said, hey, can you help us find someone? And we started thinking we were about to introduce him to a bunch of other companies. And then I remember we looked at each other and we're like, maybe this is our opportunity to go to New York. Like this, it seems like this could be it. But it also leading up to that, we rethought Sweetgreen. Mm-hmm. We redid the brand. We redid the menu. We introduced technology into the experience. That like challenge of going to this place that we were so scared of.
You say technology like an app and ordering online. Yeah,
introducing our app.
And by the way, when you were, I know you guys were roommates in D.C. in 2014, 2015, were you still roommates? Were you still living in the same place?
Yes, up until the last couple of years, we either lived with each other or on the same street.
All three of you?
Yeah, John and Nate shared a house in D.C., and in New York for a bit, and then I always lived across the street with my brother normally. But
you all have your own places now.
We're now we're all married and have our own places.
I got you. Okay. All right. Fine. All right. But did you think maybe you just have a compound for you all and your families?
We're gonna work our way back to
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. So, I mean, this is the other thing. Like, did you ever have any blowout fights? I mean, it's very unusual. Even you know, in the same room that we're all sitting in, the founders of Allbirds, we had them. And, you know, the founders of Method and a lot of co-founders went to therapists and coaches and people to work through things, which makes a lot of sense. Did you guys ever have like a coach or a therapist come and work with you or help you work through you know?
We've definitely had coaches and folks that have helped us along the way. And the other thing we realized early on was this is just a lot more fun with partners, with people that are in battle with you through the good times and bad. And we always look at solo founders and think, how do you do this? This
is so hard.
But you're not
just founders, you're friends.
Yeah.
We're friends first. No matter what the disagreement may be at work, we remember that, like, there's that foundation of love and trust. And we always just remember we have the same vision. We really do have shared, like, a shared value system in terms of how we operate and make decisions. And so any disagreements are, they're usually the stupid things. I remember some of the biggest disagreements were about who should play Sweet Life Festival. I don't know. It's one of our, I think, the greatest blessings in our life is that we get along really well.
I mean, it's the question the three of us get the most. How the hell does this work and how are you still friends? And actually today we still sit in one office at one desk. And like John said, there's a lot of trust and we know that every single day one of us will be wrong about something and one of us will be right about something. And we just know that over time it corrects itself and we trust each other.
All right, so 2016, you move to LA. You move the headquarters to LA. There are obvious reasons why. It's that California's the agriculture capital of the United States and you want to be close to. But what was your thinking? Why LA?
So it was a few reasons. The company was growing at that point. We had, I want to say, like 40 or 50 restaurants. We had about 35 people working in our support center at what we called the treehouse. But we started to think about the real long-term future of Sweetgreen, and it was a few things that one is what you talked about, was being closer to our farmers.
Okay.
The second was from just a brand and conversation standpoint. While it was cool being the outsider in D.C., we wanted to be in the center of action where people were talking about health and wellness. And then the third was from, like, a talent perspective. It started to get challenging recruiting people in our world to D.C. And so we realized it was probably this point we had while the company was still relatively small to move to L.A. But we wanted to bring the whole team with us and gave everyone a really nice, like, offer to come move with us. And what was amazing, you know, that I'm so proud of that time is every single person came with us. All 35 people at the time moved across the country. And it was such an incredible cultural, like, bonding moment for all of us to pick up and start over in a new city together.
So here's what I'm interested in, right? You know the adage, small business, small problems, big business, big problems. And just expanding isn't always a great idea. I mean, Howard Schultz, when he went back to Starbucks in 2008, closed like 900 locations because they expanded too quickly. Chipotle expanded too quickly. But this was your strategy. This was your plan when you moved to LA in 2016. It was, let's build out more stores and more stores and more stores. Did you start to think about maybe this wasn't actually the way we should think about our business?
Yeah, so we started to see the industry shift. You know, when we started Sweetgreen, people used to tell us, you know, you're lucky you're in food because it's the one thing that Amazon will never touch, which is funny now because, you know,
yeah,
Amazon
right.
owns Whole Foods and they're
sure.
trying to tackle food. But it was the industry that was not – hadn't been disrupted the way media had or travel had or you name it. But clearly that was very clearly changing.
What were you saying?
You were starting to see delivery take off. You're starting to see – you know, online ordering take off. You're just starting to see how data could be used differently in operating a restaurant. And you started to realize that just opening brick and mortar restaurants was not going to be sustainable. Just the nightmare for us was always thinking about Blockbuster. We would always say,
let's not get Blockbuster.
Let's not get Blockbuster.
Because Blockbuster, obviously, in the 1980s,
they were everything, right? And it was about going and get your videotape.
Mm-hmm.
But and they, you know, the story goes that they had an opportunity to buy Netflix and they didn't. But what happened with Blockbuster is they didn't evolve.
Yeah.
And we kind of saw that happening in our world. We saw that restaurants were very much at risk to this disruption. Even though we were ahead from a technology perspective, there was more we could do. And there was so much more we had to do to stay in front of the customer.
It wasn't enough to just make a cool restaurant with great salads.
No.
No, and I think that was the thing that we noticed the most is that the customer was changing and how they defined convenience was changing. I mean, when Sweetgreen first opened, our customers told us, wow, how convenient that I have a place now that I can walk two blocks away
and get
wait in line for only 15 minutes and get a healthy bowl. Fast forward 5 years, they're like, you know, I have to walk two blocks and wait 15 minutes
wow.
to get a healthy bowl. And so this definition of convenience was, it was a moving target. And so we saw that our customers were demanding more, and there was this, the experience had to become more frictionless.
Yeah, we just knew that the experience had to evolve. You know, the world is changing. The question is always how fast. When does what you do become stale? And we were always, like, we just have this constant fear of being disrupted. And so what we always have tried to do is disrupt ourselves so someone else does not disrupt us.
So here's where a pretty significant pivot takes place. Essentially, from what I've read, 2018, you decide we've got to really pivot, or maybe or 2017. And the pivot, just to make it really clear, because we're talking about technology and but sort of more specifically, what does the pivot mean? I mean, what does Sweetgreen 3.0 look like from a consumer's perspective? I go into the restaurant, I order salad. What? How does that change?
So there's a few parts. You know, I think we've learned over the years that it still takes a certain amount of time to build these physical restaurants. And we're at a point where sometimes change is happening quicker than we can build these things. So we've learned how to build our restaurants with enough modularity and flexibility to think about future channels. So one of the biggest differences when we build Sweetgreens today is around capacity, really thinking about delivery or Outpost or online ordering pickup.
What's Outpost?
Outpost is our newest channel that we've launched this past year and a half. And it's basically a pickup shelf system that's installed into offices or locations outside of Sweetgreen.
Oh, you can order it. It goes. It's like an Amazon locker?
Exactly. Okay.
So partnerships with office buildings, hospitals, universities, and you can pre-order your food. It's waiting for you on a shelf. And the beauty is it's completely free for the customer. So you're not paying any sort of delivery fee and you have the convenience of delivery.
Right. And you don't have to build a shop for it. So you can have like a central kitchen in a city where the salads are made and then just deliver.
Yeah. I mean, we don't think the going and eating in-store experience is ever going away. But people are craving convenience in addition to. And there are certain occasions where people may want delivery or may want something direct to their office. And brands have to evolve to that consumer's expectation.
All right. You have this idea and this plan, and you had to raise money to make it happen because you're going to you had to make a big technology investment and bring in like data engineers and like there's an article I think about you in Inc. and it was like Sweetgreen is a food company that's becoming a technology company or something like that. And you went to your executive team and you present this plan, and within a year they all left, with the exception of like the chief financial officer. All your senior leaders, your president, and the other executives who had come with a lot of experience from the food industry, they left, presumably because they didn't buy into this idea. I think – and this is like a year ago. It's not that long ago we're talking about.
Yeah, it was 2 years ago.
2 years ago, you basically – your entire top-level execs are gone.
Yeah, it was one of the most challenging times in our history. They didn't see the world changing as fast as we did, and – what we saw required a lot more risk and a lot more time versus the path we were on.
And probably slower revenue growth.
Slower growth up front. Yeah. It was the vision that we established was, let's slow down to speed up. We're going to slow down, build a new model, and then we're going to speed up. And I think there was a lot of people there that were less open to the change. And it was a very challenging year for all of us.
It was way more risk. And you have to realize, just to paint the picture, you know, 2015 and 16 were two of our best years ever. And we could have very easily, it would have been way easier to stay on that path in the short term.
Just keep going.
Just keep going and then go public and maybe cash out and then maybe something crashes. But the three of us always wanted to build Sweetgreen to be around for 50 or 100 years. And we knew that if we didn't build it the right way, that we were going to hit a wall at some point.
We could see around the corner that we were going off a cliff. It felt like we were being blockbustered.
Okay, now, to be fair, in 10 years from now or in 20 years from now, you may be proven to be geniuses with foresight and your model will be studied in business schools. There's always also a possibility that maybe you're wrong because you're right in the middle of this pivot now,
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, I'm on your executive team and I have got 20, 30 years of experience in the industry. I'm going to say, guys, the model is there. The playbook is there. Let's open up more restaurants. We're doing well. We're going to make more money. We open up. We go public. We're going to be fine. I mean, you even – this is public. I'm not tagging out of school here. You've had board members like Gary Hirschberg who left the board because he was saying the same thing. And I think, you know, at that time certainly and even now still because the concept hasn't been proven, they might have a point.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We just saw things differently.
we really saw things differently, and that, to Nick's point, we want to build something for generations. And we knew we had to not only change now, but build a culture of being able to continually change. And we felt like we were becoming one of those restaurants that just copy-pasted. And that's never what we wanted to build. What we wanted to build was something that constantly evolved.
So when you went through this, like when you announced this to the senior staff and then basically, you know, they start to leave, was there situations where you actually saying to people, please don't just give us a chance, stay? Or were you like, okay, go?
A little bit of both. Each one was its own situation. But I remember like the last one where we thought it couldn't get any worse. And I remember being in Boston. I was Nick and I and our assistant at the time, JY, and we're in the Boston airport after visiting all the stores in Boston. And I get the, you know, you get the text from someone, and it's always like the worst text when someone says, hey, can you talk? Pick up the phone, and it's like, you know, Nick looks at my face. He's like, another one? And I'm like, yeah. And then so the last person quits.
And it was then like 10 people.
It was like eight people, I think. And then our flight is canceled, and we're sitting in the Boston airport, and we're just like, oh, God, what are we going to do?
I mean, I'll be honest with you. If my whole team from How I Built This left over the course of 6 or 8 months, I would start to doubt my own judgment. I would say, what am I doing wrong? On the one hand, I think that's a natural human response. On the other hand, it takes a lot of resilience to withstand that and to forge ahead.
But, you know, while the whole leadership team left, not the whole team left.
Yeah.
And there were so many people that stayed with us and are still here with us and stepped up. And it also gave us the opportunity to bring in fresh blood with this, yeah, you know, with this vision in mind. And so at the time, it was so painful. But looking back, it was such a blessing.
And to your point, we had all those thoughts. You know, we'd ask ourselves, what are we doing? You know, the first person leaves, we're like, okay, fine. The second, the third. By the fifth or sixth, you know, the three of us are looking at each other saying, like, are we doing the right thing here? And again, back to the point of, like, having two co-founders, having them here, just, like, the three of us together reassuring each other. If we were any of us doing this by ourselves, I'm not sure we would have done the same thing.
Yeah. And today you're still convinced that this emphasis on tech and other ways of getting Sweetgreen to customers is the right way to go?
100%.
Yeah. More sure than ever.
But we'll see. But you'll see, right? Because it hasn't – it's going to take time. It's gonna take a few
years. And we're not going to get it all right. There's going to be – and there are parts of this that we get wrong and we learn and we iterate and, you know, we open new versions of Sweetgreen that have parts of it that don't work. And that's part of the journey is the failures.
But that was very much part of it. It was going from a place of, hey, we have this one thing that works. Let's just keep doing it to let's create a culture of where it's safe to fail and okay to try things, and some will work and some won't. And Outpost, for example, is one of those things that was a little trial that now has almost 1,000 outposts in less than a year. We want a culture and a company that continues to innovate and evolve and not that just does the same thing. Because with the companies that we look around the world, the ones that we admire, are not doing the same thing that they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. They're continuing to evolve.
How big do you want this to be? I mean, do you want this to be a Starbucks, I think, is the biggest food chain in the world after McDonald's, or maybe Subway, I don't know. I mean, do you want it to be that big? Do you want people, you know, going to Sweetgreens all around the world? Can you even do that? I mean,
we want to have a really big impact. We want to create a global, iconic, enduring brand that changes people's relationship with food and changes and has an impact on a sustainable impact on the future of food. But what I like to think about a lot is, what if every McDonald's was a Sweetgreen? How would agriculture be different? How would the environment be different? How would the health, people's health be different? And that's what gets me really excited. And whatever number of restaurants that is, like, let's just keep going. And what we've always said is, go as far as you can see. Once you get there, you'll be able to see further.
How much do you think the success of this business has to do with your intelligence and skill, and how much is because of luck in your view, Nicholas?
You know, I think luck plays a big part in any success. And I think there's good luck and there's bad luck, and we've had multitudes of both. I believe it's what you do with that luck, how you either double down on the good luck and use that as momentum or try to fight off the bad luck and not let it sink you. And so much of our success has been about the grit. You know, the decisions you make every day, the work that goes in, you know, I credit our partnership a lot to how we've gotten through this together. But So much of it is what you do with that luck and how you actually capitalize on it.
Jonathan, when you reflect on the whole arc of these last 13 and a half years?
I mean, it's so much luck went into this. The fact that I walked into Georgetown and met Nick the first day. The fact that I had the opportunity to go to Georgetown in the first place. There's so many things that were lucky breaks for us. But to Nick's point, it was then using that momentum when we were lucky and also having the resilience for all of those times that we almost failed. Because in this 13 years, it's just like being able to survive, to live another day, to get another chance for a lucky shot.
That's Jonathan Niemann and Nicholas Jamay, co-founders, along with Nathaniel Rue of Sweetgreen. Now, normally, this would be the end of the show, but of course, we are not living in normal times. So just a few days ago, about a month after we recorded this interview, I called up Nick and Jonathan to ask them about how their business is going right now since the pandemic hit. First of all, before we start, where are you right now? Nicholas, where are you?
So I'm sitting in the guest bedroom of my home in Venice, which has become my makeshift office.
In California. And Jonathan, where are you?
I'm also at home. I'm at my home in West Hollywood, Los Angeles, also in a guest bedroom turned makeshift office where I'm spending all of my time now.
Yeah. So obviously, so much has changed since our interview just a few weeks ago. Tell me the situation with Sweetgreen. I mean, I have to imagine you've had to, at the very least, furlough employees and shut down stores. What's going on?
So we've had to shift the way we operate all of our restaurants. So all of our dining rooms have been closed, all of our front lines have been closed, and we've shifted to a digital-only operation. So we take orders via pickup, which is done contactless, as well as contactless delivery on our app and through a few marketplaces. Because of where our restaurants are physically located, our business is especially we're being impacted in a very, very dramatic way.
So in our interview that we did a couple weeks ago, one of the really most fascinating things about that interview was your sort of discussion about your pivot, this idea of people could pick up their salads and lockers and order digitally, and there'd be a whole kind of new ecosystem around it. Right now in the current environment, can that still work? Can that still operate?
So as the whole world moved to work from home, our outpost business completely disappeared overnight. It was a large part of our business and the fastest growing part of our business. And so it literally overnight disappeared. But what we were able to do was redirect all of our outpost capability and logistics towards the people on the front line. So specifically, we were able to redirect and set up outposts at over 100 hospitals around the country. We started by funding them ourselves. And then just recently, we partnered with Jose Andres and his World Central Kitchen to raise additional funds for that. So far, we funded over 100,000 meals for these hospitals, and we're just getting started here.
And you're giving those away. You're not.
Yeah, we're giving the food away. We're giving the bowls completely free to people on the front line. When we announced it, we got 10,000 hospitals reached out to be part of the program. So the response was overwhelming, and I think it just made us realize that, you know, during these times, while you want to save your business and, you know, that's important, it's take care of your own people, but then figure out how you can use your company for the greater good of the community.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for 13 years we've been talking about why we started Sweetgreen and our cultures and values and how we show up every day. And to be honest, they haven't really been tested to an extreme till this moment, right? And we've had some challenging moments over the 13 years, and we've always been super proud of how we've used those values. But to be honest, it hasn't been since this past month that we've really taken stock and said, this is when they really get tested.
And Jonathan, I know that you and Nick and your third co-founder, Nathaniel, recently met face-to-face, socially distanced. What was that conversation like? What did you guys talk about?
You know, we sat around and we told ourselves we can't think about rebuilding our business the way we were building it before. And honestly, it felt like we were sitting back in our dorm room at Georgetown, and we literally took a whiteboard out. And the question was, if we were starting Sweetgreen today, what would we build?
let's go do that right now instead of just going back to our old plans, or we need to be proactive around this and start to plan for this, the rebound and the new normal. And so, we, you know, we've always believed that with crisis comes opportunity, and this is a crisis like none of us could have ever imagined or any of us have ever experienced, but with this will come opportunity. And so we've really tried to think about how we can use this time to invest in the business and to come out stronger than we went into it.
John, Nick, thanks for the update, guys. And we're wishing you a lot of luck and sending you good energy. And we hope that Sweetgreen will get through this and stronger than ever, and that we can go have a salad, you know, pretty soon.
Thank you, Guy.
And thanks to all of you for listening to the show this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can also write to us at hibt@npr.org. And if you want to send a tweet, it's @HowIBuiltThis. Our show was produced this week by Casey Herman, with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Julia Carney, Candace Lim, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Rainey Toll. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR.
Not everybody wants to run around the White House or Congress all day. That's where the NPR Politics Podcast comes in. At 5 p.m., NPR's best political reporters get together and break down the biggest political stories. No noise, just friends making sense of Washington. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast every weekday.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? Then check out the daily news podcast, The Best One Yet. Every morning on The Best One Yet, hosts Nick and Jack serve up to three of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies, you're going for that promotion at work, or you just want to know the trends before your friends, be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus, and for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. I'm Misha Brown, and I'm the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Every week, guests join me to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time. Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? They never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.